You're listening to Type Radio. My name is Eric Brandt. Now we're talking.
Guten Abend. Jetzt gibt es Type Radio. Type Radio.
You listen to Type Radio. My name is Donald.
I'm Lisa.
We're at the AGI Open Conference in Rotterdam. It's September 24th, 2019, and our first guest is Eric Brandt. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you.
You know the typical first question, are you religious?
No.
Why not?
I grew up all over the world, so I was born in America, but we lived in Africa, Germany, and Egypt. So I have to say that when I was a kid in Germany, my best grades were in religion and not in grammar, because I could relate to the stories a little bit more, but I never quite got religion, as they say. So, but I believe in all things.
And you how come you moved around so much?
My father was a teacher, so we left the United States 3 years after I was born, and then we were in Malawi and Cameroon. And then we moved back to Germany. He's German. Mm-hmm. And there he started to move up in academia, and he became a headmaster of international schools. So I followed him there through Cairo.
And was he your inspiration for teaching now?
Or? Absolutely. Yeah. No, from a very young age. And my youngest brother is an educator as well. And so, yeah, it was natural.
And what would you say would be a lesson? What did you learn from it? What was the most important thing that you learned?
I think a love of learning, and a love of lifelong learning. It's a common expression, but I'm absolutely sure of that. He was always challenging us with questions, and that became one of the reasons that I, in undergraduate, that I actually studied philosophy. I didn't study graphic design, but I fell in love with questions. And so even if we were driving on the Autobahn, we would be playing games like, okay, what's the next kilometer sign for Milan going to be, or something like that. So that's the kind of guy he was. Fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, shall I continue? Yeah. I keep going. Okay, to go back, do you have ritual?
I don't think I do. I mean, I'm a habitual coffee maker in the morning. That's the first thing I do. I suppose that will count as a ritual, yeah. But not prior to work or anything like that.
You're not superstitious? Or
I'm superstitious. I knock 3 times on the side of an airplane when I get on one. That's my only superstition.
Doesn't help?
Well, so far so good, knock on wood.
To go a little bit back in time, we read that you started as an illustrator in Japan. Like this, how does this come together? Yeah. When you said you didn't study design? Or
yeah, no, after I finished my undergraduate education in philosophy, I actually moved back to Germany. Then I moved to Japan, and like a lot of foreigners there, I started teaching English. And then I was living in Fukuoka, which is in Kyushu, and there was an English language magazine starting. They were that city was about to host the Universiade, the University Olympics. So there was a big push for English language, and so this magazine was starting. And I introduced myself to them, and I had been drawing this really bad comic for friends. But they liked it because it wasn't a manga comic, and they asked if I would do some things, and then they found that I could edit, I could write, and so I worked my way into the position, and there I started learning quark and Japanese characters and memorizing print function by 1 down, 4 over, 3 down, things like that. But I was exposed to a lot of really good Japanese designers, and so slowly I found a word for things that I had always been doing, and it was graphic design, which I didn't really know before through that.
Yeah. Okay, so that was the earliest professional experience. So you were...
Yeah, and it was more, it started in a sense with journalism and editing, and, you know, it was a city magazine. We were looking at, you know, restaurants and stories, and bands like Radiohead would come through, and Beastie Boys and things like that, and I would go to their concerts and write them up, and yeah, it was great.
But it's quite sort of happenstance introduction, like almost like stumbling into the world of graphic design.
Yeah, exactly, right place, right time. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even, I was at that magazine for I think almost 2 years. I mean, even during that time, I mean, we were making a monthly, so it was, you know, just a big push every 4 weeks. And I didn't necessarily see it as a career. It was just where I was, and it was really fun and, you know, really, really challenging. And I loved my colleagues. We were a small part of a big parent company, and they had the magazine in the city, and that was a really cool environment. You know, things happening every day. You know, leave work at 2 a.m. and come back at 7. Yeah.
And are you in contact with any of the people that you used to work with?
No. You know, this was, what, 93 to 96. So, yeah, it's been a long time.
Okay. But you said you put words to what you were doing already. So this is something then you were illustrating from quite young, no? Or you were doing...
Yeah, I was always drawing. You know, my mother was, an artist, and I'd been drawing, and, you know, like everyone, drawing and painting since I was a kid. And when I finally, you know, came back to the States and went to graduate school, it all came together. I was like, oh, right, this is it. This is what I've been doing. I've been drawing, I've been telling stories, I've been making really bad comics, I've been making really bad punk rock posters and things like that. So, yeah, then it all made sense. You know, when I was in university finishing my philosophy degree, I took a few art classes, and I had a teacher who told me, like, oh, you should go, you know, I was in Virginia, and she recommended someday, she's like, you, judging by my work, she's like, you should study graphic design, and you should go to this school, VCU. And I thought, what is she talking about? I had no idea what she meant. It was really ignorant, I suppose, but yeah, it's crazy. It's really crazy.
And of course, we want to talk about, and now how I'm going to pronounce it properly, Visiones Tipográfica.
Exactly. Yeah, Visiones Tipográfica.
How was the project initiated?
Yeah, it started. I was actually
and
due.
Why?
No. I was due for a sabbatical at my school in Minneapolis, and I literally started physically constructing the board, and it was going to be a place where over that time I would post experiments and things like that. I'd always wanted to do something like that, I just started making it, and as I was putting it together, I thought, you know, this would be much more interesting if I would play with other people too and invite people. I had a blog before that I used to write called Geotipografica, and actually that was really a precursor, because it was the same process. I would just be writing and contacting people all over the world. I was trying to bring their stories, you know, first to my students, and then, you know, the little blog started gathering a following and got bigger. And in a way, this was the perfect continuation of that kind of thinking, but in my mind, even better, because these people from all over the world, it, you know, kind of became an extension of my classroom in a way, because it was a very open brief. But yeah, that's how it started.
So, but first, did you showcase your students, or how, when you say extension of your classroom, in what sense?
No, at first it was by invitation only.
Okay.
And I reached out to a really broad cross-section of people. So, current students, former students, living legends, you know, that I was familiar with, other people whose work I was interested in and, you know, had contact with from the blog. And so that was a really important time, because, you know, luckily people responded, and it allowed me to sort of seed the project in a way. And I wanted to keep it invitation only, actually. A friend of mine, the French type designer Benoit, Bodhuin, or I won't, Bodhuin, I can't pronounce it correctly. But he was like, you should just open it up for submissions. And I said I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to be the person that said no. You know, and it was fun at the time curating, the invitations that I had extended and putting things together that weren't necessarily, intended. But then one day I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And I opened it up for submissions. And I was really pleasantly surprised because I think the quality got even better because people had sort of seen this strange project in a place where it really shouldn't be. And they responded to that opportunity. And so, yeah, I got thousands of submissions. So
what were your parameters, like, to describe the project for listeners?
I mean, it was defined as a place for typographic experimentation in a public setting. But I allowed, I think, because I'm a teacher, I allowed a really broad interpretation of the word typography or typographic in that sense. So I think that's what made it so flexible and so deep too. So it wasn't just designers responding to the project. I had artists, photographers, poets, other people who just saw it as it was intended, like just a place for experimentation, and that was also very broadly defined.
And how long did the piece stay on the
initially building? What I wanted to do was not you can't quite do it, but I wanted to simulate the speed of imagery that we're exposed to now on a daily basis. In the beginning it was a week, 2 weeks, but then especially after I opened up for submissions, I got so many, and I felt an obligation. I would respond to people and say, yes, you're going to go up, but I can't tell you when, and I'm not sure when. And so actually in 2014, like about 6 months into the project, I was hanging almost every day. But I totally forgot about that until we made the book, because I had to make a timeline and, contact people again. And I was looking at it and was like, how did I do that? But toward the end of the project, it became more rhythmic, and it would be once or maximum twice a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that is a ritual in a way, no? Okay.
That you're right. I should have thought of that. It did become a ritual, and it really gets into your blood, especially where I am in Minneapolis. The challenge of continuing the project through the winter months there, which can be 6-7 months of the year sometimes, and quite brutally cold, and the to document the pieces. That was also tricky. If you go through the blog of all the postings, you'll see the light changing all the time, and that's because
of the weather,
etc. So I would, especially in the winter, you would have to pick your moments pretty carefully to make sure that the weed paste would actually dry before, or freeze mostly in some cases. So
would people come to see you putting up? Like, was it an opening every time? I mean, like, you'd be an alcoholic, I think, at the end.
It was really interesting. People in the neighborhood started changing the way they walked their dogs, they rode their bicycles, the way they went to work. But I kind of regret that. We talked about it. My wife and I talked about it sometime. Well, we should have a party or something like that. But we never quite got there. But people did know my rhythms, and some people would stop by to when I was hanging or things.
Checking it out.
Yeah, and I thought at the beginning of the project that there might be some graffiti at some point or some tagging or something, but nothing like that ever happened. So I thought that would have been cool, actually. Someone I talked to one time on the street was saying that they thought that the project had respect, and so in the neighborhood.
Yeah, it's almost religious. There, in the sense that you sometimes see churches where they put out these signs and they. But this is almost a design religion.
Yeah, and it became, for me. I mean, I definitely got uncomfortable if it was Thursday, And I thought, oh, what am I going to hang on Sunday, for example? And then, you know, just looking at the weather and how that was going to be. There were a couple of times in the project where the submissions kind of came to a point where, you know, I had things in reserve, but I wasn't sure if it was the right time for that poster. Instead of rejecting something outright, I would just put it on hold. And I found over the course of the project that, you know, sometimes this sort of long-form narrative was developing, and then suddenly something would be appropriate. Mm. So I tried to, you know, keep a mental picture of what I had, you know, on the hard drive, and then I would contact people. Some people waited 4 years, and I would contact them to say, hey, does this still represent you? Would you mind if? No one ever said no. So,
Do you have pieces of work that you will never forget? Like, that really is something.
Yeah, you know, at the beginning of the project, there was this young type designer, Kia. I will mispronounce his name as well. Kia Tashbigu from London, and he had this, I thought, really aggressively contemporary aesthetic, but also very strong political orientation. And to me, that was really, all the pieces that I submitted myself were invariably political. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't a requirement, but, you know, his piece was really important to me because I thought, okay, now we're talking. Sorry. Had to be said. It was hanging in the air. Yeah.
And is it that the work is pasted over each other?
So yeah.
Is all the work there? Like, how many centimeters of work?
Yeah. We have these pillars in Amsterdam where you can wear your lounge and put your poster up, and sure. They get these sort of bellies after, because they leave them on. They get sort of chubby over the time.
Yeah. No, I remember those from growing up in Germany too. No, that's actually one of the other rituals of the project, now that I'm thinking about it this way. But over time, it would get so thick, and then there might have been a rainstorm, or it was especially cold, and things would start peeling up. So at the beginning, I really didn't anticipate this, but close to the beginning, we had this really big rainstorm, and I thought, oh, I think I have to take these down. And it was fantastic, because I started peeling them off, and then there was this whole undiscovered, completely reversed experience, and completely unexpected collaboration starting to appearing. And so I developed a technique with hot water to break down the wheat paste a little more slowly, and I have an old painter's tool that I would use, and it became like a décollage process, and I could make these, you know, there's obviously some chance involved, but I got pretty skilled with using this knife and the water, and you could take things off, and the wheat paste had this incredible quality where less than a millimeter, you know, obviously much less than a millimeter, but some of the colored grounds, if you remove them carefully, they would actually leave an impression that was never there. And so, you know, the poster under it would get that. And it was fantastic. And so, and then all these people would be sort of rediscovered as I was going through the layers down to the bottom. And so I would obsessively document that and post that. And those were really popular. People really enjoyed those.
But do you have also parts where it's just the objects themselves?
Yeah, I've saved most of the stuff that I've taken down. It's in the back of my garage. There was one purge at one point. But I have actually one I just did recently. I got almost 3 perfect panels off. So now I'm saving those for something. I don't know what yet.
Go on.
Where do you think you're going with the project? Is there a notion of that?
Ficciones, you know, officially ended in 2018, and it felt like it came to a sort of a good organic end. I was at peace with it. It felt like, you know, the people were okay with it. I still get submissions, unfortunately, which I'm, you know, happy to write them back. But, you know, since that time, I've just been doing my own work on it. So it's continuing as this thing, largely political. Lately, I've been doing these, you know, more purely aesthetic, my little packaging portraits, as I call them. But I'm actually thinking sometime in the future it might be okay to start the project again. So I'm gonna give that some time though. because I'm not sure.
And was it always an intention to make a book out of the project, or?
You know, in the beginning, I actually told people I had a, you know, about page. I said outright that a book might be made, but I waited too long. And before too long, I had this volume, and I knew that there was no way that I could, A, self-publish, that I could afford to self-publish. So at a point, I actually did think, you know, I wanted to approach a publisher, and I did. And they were really interested, but it didn't fit their publishing model. And it was because it was all online. Mm. And they thought, well, you know, this doesn't, but they were, you know, very sweet about it. But that conversation was actually a really important point, because I thought in my head, like, right, the project should be over, and then you make a book.
Yeah.
But by chance, I met the publisher, Mark Gowing, and we had this conversation, and he said he wanted to make a book. So we actually started a conversation almost a year and a half before the project ended. And we started working on the book before the project ended. And he was really generous to let me go as long as I did, after we had decided we were already in the process. But that was also a motivation, in a positive way, to find an ending. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how do you divide your time between your client work and work on the ficciones? Because I can imagine you get so absorbed.
Yeah.
So,
you know. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, at the start of this project, I became chair of the design department at MCAD, where I teach. And so that already took most time away from client work, which left me with, you know, one class a semester that I'm teaching. So this actually became almost everything that I was doing, aside from small projects here and there. But it complemented, I think, the way, you know, teaching has, I think you would agree, it's always been a really important part of both developing work and creating new work. So it was just a natural fit.
Yeah. And now?
And now?
Now?
Now we'll see what happens. Yeah. No, I'm quite enjoying. You know, I always had a hesitance, you know, especially in the beginning, of adding my own work to the project, especially because, you know, one of the first pieces that I did, you know, at the beginning were some experiments I had done, the original Ficciones Tipografica that I, you know, I just did a workshop here today on. But over time, it was actually my daughter's daycare was raided by ICE, the immigration, I have strong words for them, officials in the United States, and they took away some of her teachers, and I posted this protest about, you know, common phrase in the world, you know, human being is illegal in German Spanish. And after that, most of my contributions were invariably political, because I had this feeling like, well, I have this platform and the stage, and things should be said. But I did question that. I sometimes worried I'm pushing this in. But other contributors were equally, as I mentioned, Kia, especially, mm-hmm. political. So those political statements also had, you know, an opportunity for typography. I think in my case, I would try to allow the message to mm-hmm. to prevail, as opposed to a certain style.
Did you get reactions on the messages that you were posting?
Did.
No, but
yeah.
Also not on not online, but also in the neighborhood, for example.
Yeah, in the neighborhood, there were there weren't any outright fights or anything like that. But some people left some notes, you know, some pro-Trump notes,
yeah.
And you know, some people would yell something from a car sometimes when I was out there, if there, you know, there was one that had been up recently, and this is after the project ended. I had a protest about collusion, and, you know, these words that are so common, unfortunately, right now in American politics, and it had been up for a week. And somebody came by one night, and I remember waking up, I heard this screaming and yelling outside, and I thought, oh, it's just a drunk going home late. But I came out the next day, and my daughter Beatrix had gone outside, and she said, oh, come look at this. And I came, and there's blood all over the place, and the thing had been ripped down. But it was it was quite fitting, actually, because WePaste makes paper really hard and really sharp. And so this guy had been ripping this thing down, and, you know, to protest the obviously anti-Trump statement. And so it was kind of funny, you know. Ficciones bites back, you know.
Yeah. It will not be taken down lightly.
When you talk about political statements, how open were you, or are you open to other points of view?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question, especially in this time. The project that I have running is now called Tipografica Politica, mm-hmm. and I thought, okay, this is the logical successor. It's just me right now. And I have thought, okay, well, what if I invited people to this? And precisely because of the question you ask, I thought it wouldn't be as good, because there, especially in these times, especially in the United States, I would not be supporting a divergent opinion from what I think needs to be a broad-based pro-people agenda, because it's become so divisive and so divided, and the message, you can't even, there's
no discussion.
Yeah, it's black and white now.
It's gray area.
Yeah, and that's what's making it really scary. But, you know, I thought a lot about your question, and I made a decision, like, I couldn't open it up because I would say no, and then, but, you know, maybe that would be okay too, but I don't know. It's
maybe
difficult.
It has to be on the other side of that. Yeah. You have two sides of the house. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really great idea. There's another side to the garage that's actually private. You know, so it's maybe that's where I could put the opposing view, but then we would have to look at it, and I don't know if I could stomach that. But it would be, that would be an interesting tension. Yeah.
But also with posters being sort of bold statements in a way, the message will be larger than it actually is, which makes the discussion right away on there.
No, I totally agree. Gosh, yeah, now I'm sitting here thinking about it. Like, it would be really cool to have opposing views. It's funny, there was one, you know, I think they've split up now, but they were Ebeke, it was a collaborative design group, and they were based in London. They had a really interesting political one, but it was actually kind of taken from an old television show. But it had the image of, I think, right-wing associations, but it was tongue-in-cheek and actually went the other way.
Yeah. And if you look through all the years, do you see a change in the... I think there is a change, but what is that change that you see in communication?
I think, you know, one thing for sure... a lot of younger designers, especially. I mean, it became a real testing ground, and it also became a recruiting ground, so to speak. A lot of the, you know, leading design blogs, you know, if you had something in Ficciones, you were close to being discovered, and that was, you know, I know that happened. I know it was also influential in a lot of agencies, and I had actually an interesting image that was sort of surreptitiously slipped to me of an agency that had been working on a famous brand, and the wall was full of images from the project, especially Benoit's work, and I think the resulting logo was very, very much inspired by what he did. But I do see a shift in some of the focus that especially younger designers had, and it also helped me to see, and you know, and I mean this with the most respect, especially when I was first studying graphic design. I think it's fair to say, and it's still fair to say, that the world looks to Holland for contemporary and experimental work. Through this project, I found all these other areas, these young French students, this incredible student, at the time he was a student, Darius Wu in Singapore, and so and other contributions from Korea, etc. It became clear to me that what some people, I think maybe sometimes accurately, call trends or worry, you know, that certain things, that it became clear to me that there is a global design language developing, and that you didn't have to isolate your identity of in terms of your work, in terms of a national association, that you were actually playing with a larger group of people. And, you know, I think a lot of us, you know, saw those things happening on Tumblr, and there was, you know, the Tumblr aesthetic and things that, you know, people started pointing to. And I actually, I just thought, oh, I think it's okay. You know, they're all talking to each other. Maybe somebody's taking something that they shouldn't, but, you know, more than often than not, I think people were really speaking to each other, and that was pan-national in regard. So I think one of the most important, I like to think that's one of the most important things I saw.
Yeah. It cannot change, I think, from that, you know, because of technology, correct? There is no way, unless you isolate yourself completely.
Yeah. Yeah,
it is not possible anymore.
Well, it's such a wonderful world. I mean, the young designers live in now. I mean, they can collaborate. They can start studios without borders, and they do. And I just think that's the most wonderful thing. I mean, when we were younger, when I was seeing in mid '90s, you waited for Emigre magazine every once in a while, and that was your window to a contemporary world. And you would wait and wait, and then you had it, or, you know, somebody had one that you hadn't seen. You know, now it's minute by minute, you know, that you could find something that's inspiring, or, you know, something to share a heart with.
Yeah, exactly. But also find an audience, find a client base. It's everything.
There's
no boundaries. But there's also, like, on the downside, it's like you're losing local flavor in a way. Because of that.
Yeah, I suppose that's true, you know, and I don't know. I feel invariably, you know, there's waves of that. There's, let's say, the global style, and then maybe there's a reinvestment in a certain heritage or something like that, or an aesthetic that's associated, you know. But I, for me personally, you know, I've never had that. A sense of national identity. Given how I've grown up, and my work is, I talk about my work that way. It's more of a conglomerate in nature, and both visually and aesthetically. So yeah, I can't think. I envy people in my life who had grew up in one place, because they have roots, as they say, and, you know, they associate with things. But that was not my life, and so I just think that way anyway.
How would you like to be remembered?
Oh my God. How would I like to be remembered?
Yeah, we have some confrontational ones.
No, that's okay. Speaking idealistically, I'd really like to be remembered as a good teacher. And I think a good teacher is someone who, like this project, has a broad appreciation for idiosyncrasy, and not someone who tried to impose their view of graphic design on others, but tried to teach from and to idiosyncrasy. And I often say, as many people, one of my heroes, absolute heroes, is Karel Martens, because I often tell my students that I want to grow old as a designer. I think that's a really hard thing to do. It's a very ageist occupation. But I look to people like that who have continued learning and continued experimenting and continued reinventing themselves, that's my goal, and I think that's what a good teacher is. So I think I'd like to be remembered like that.
Thank you
so much. Such an honor.
Guten Abend. Jetzt gibt es Type Radio. Radio.